It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Ho, ho, ho. Morning.
All right.
I bet you didn't know Santa was a rapper.
Yeah. Well, yeah, those...
Oh, with a W, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, they... Oh, that's very clever. All right. Kind of a slower week for news.
Yes, and next week will be even slower, but yeah. We'll deal with that.
All right.
We'll talking that. Never seems to be a problem on this show.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get started with local, which there wasn't a heck of a lot of, but we actually neglected in mentioning it last week when it would have been timely, but Christine Gregoire doing a punt.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know if it was, I think it was announced on Friday and then reported on Saturday, and we just didn't catch it in time for the show, but Christine Gregoire made a decision a week ago to not make a decision on the Alaska Way Viaduct and said she's going to pass it back to Seattle voters. Now, this is particularly irritating because Seattle City Council in September, when a new cost estimate came out on the tunnel option, increasing it by $1 billion or so, and a poll came out showing that the tunnel option would not pass where it sent to voters, the Seattle City Council punted and gave it to Christine Gregoire in the state legislature rather than what had been planned, which was to give it to Seattle voters. Therefore, all we have done by the actions of first the Seattle City Council and now Christine Gregoire is we're right back where we started in September. The only difference is that we're going to have delayed the vote by a year with all of the increases in cost that are associated with delaying the project by a year, not to mention the, you know, additional risk that there will be an earthquake that will just knock the whole thing down in the extra year. So once again, the circular firing squad that does seem to be local government has done a bang-up job, no pun intended, but, you know, use it if you like it, on not making a decision, and it's really getting kind of irritating.
Mm. All right, and she also had a decision this week on relating to oil and Puget Sound.
Yeah, and this, you know, I have to say, I've generally been fairly impressed with Christine Gregoire in the couple of years that she's been governor. I think she's done a pretty good job, certainly a better job than I was expecting. But these two decisions, the Alaska Way Viaduct and the Oil Study Advisory Council, are not things I'm impressed with. The Advisory Council, in this case, is the council that is composed of environmentalists, industry people, government types, etc., that are that try to figure out how best to respond to an oil spill should it happen in Puget Sound. It's part of Gregoire's, it's been there all along, but it's certainly part of any plan to clean up Puget Sound, since an oil spill is the number one environmental threat to Puget Sound at this point. Unfortunately, Gregoire this week announced that she was going to shift the home of the advisory council, as it were, so that it will now fall under the Department of Ecology. The only problem with this is that the Department of Ecology is widely viewed inside and outside environmental circles as being, shall we say, overly friendly to oil interests in this state. So it really is a way of gutting, or as I think the PI headline said, defanging the advisory council. So it really is kind of a step back for environmentalism in the cleanup of Puget Sound. It's kind of too bad.
All right. Well, related to that and jumping to national, Exxon this week got a big break.
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco, ruled that Exxon's fine for the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince Edward William Sound in 1989 was going to be reduced from $5 billion to $2.5 billion because under new laws shielding corporations from liability for these sorts of things, the $5 billion reward was retroactively, I guess, just way too expensive. And, a small struggling company like ExxonMobil really couldn't afford it. Now, where is that extra $2.5 billion going to come from? Well, it's all largely already been spent, and it comes from taxpayers, federal taxpayers and taxpayers in the state of Alaska. It certainly doesn't send an encouraging message to the oil industry that if you screw up that badly, you're going to be hurt financially by it. ExxonMobil, of course, is posting record profits these days and has for a couple of different quarters this year. Just unfortunately, a real unfortunate decision by the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, I think what was their last one was like $10 billion or thereabouts, where they could have paid this the entire fine easily.
Yeah, very easily.
Still had $5 billion to boot.
Yeah. But, you know, we have a few too many luxury jets and private yachts that still have to be bought by some of the major shareholders.
All right, moving along. Article out this week that at least via the internet was getting heavy circulation about the U.S. and bioweapons.
Yeah, Francis Boyle, the University of Illinois professor, who is a longtime expert on international law, particularly when it comes to nuclear weapons, and he's done a lot of good things for various protesters in different parts of the country who have been charged with trying to interfere with nuclear weapons and nuclear weapon deployment, and that includes the folks over at Ground Zero in Kitsap County. I believe Boyle is going to be in town next month for a trial of Bangor sub-base protesters over in Kitsap County.
I was thinking it was for Watata's trial.
Oh, is it for Watata's trial?
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh, okay. I know there's also a trial going on for...
there's multiple trials.
Yes. many trials in our era. But in any event, he's really quite well known as an expert witness in these sorts of things, written a number of books, et cetera. He is now claiming that, according to a couple of secret executive orders signed by President Bush in 2002, that the United States is now spending billions of dollars on offensive capabilities for nuclear and... rather for biological and chemical war weapons. And this, of course, would be illegal under any number of different international treaties as well as U.S. law. But Bush seems to have gone ahead and done it anyway, if you believe Francis Boyle. And, of course, the Pentagon is not commenting on any of this. And we'll see whether it gets picked up by any more mainstream media outlets. Mm. Or corporate media outlets, I should say. I don't think you can call them mainstream anymore.
All right, and finally on National, you have a Sleaze of the Week?
Yes, there's always Sleaze of the Week. Even in Christmas, there's a Sleaze of the Week, and of course, there'll be plenty of coal to pass around to this year. Particularly this week, we had an incident down in Tucson, Arizona, where about a dozen military recruiters have been popped by the FBI as part of an extensive sting operation. Turns out these recruiters are alleged to have been trafficking in and transporting cocaine from military recruiting offices. Army and I believe the Marines and some National Guard recruiters were involved that were in at least one case also distributing out of the trunk of their military recruiting vehicle cars. The brightest and the best in the military have another PR debacle on their hands.
What is the new Army slogan? Don't they have the new slogan? There's like Army and then there's, I can't remember it, but I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
There's cocaine, and now there's Army cocaine.
Exactly. There's dead, and then there's Army dead. There's, you know, obnoxious, and there's Army obnoxious, et cetera. Yeah, no, I think it's strong, and then there's Army strong is the actual slogan.
Yes, you are correct.
But,
it used to be an army of
but
one.
It's so ripe for parody and reinterpretation that it's not even funny. Well, actually, it is quite funny, but...
All right, let's jump over to
you. You wonder what consulting brain trust gave them that one.
Well, there's a bunch going for Washington State as well that are you really got to wonder why they spent a penny on it.
Yep.
Jumping over to international, a lot happening as every week in Iraq.
Yeah, not a surprise that the American political establishment, while was largely taking the week off, because next week too, because of the holidays, oddly enough, in the Islamic world, they're not doing any of that. But the biggest news of the week, of course, did come from Washington, where President Bush first fessed up for the very first time that we're not doing very well in Iraq. And then after that, promptly called in his Wednesday press conference for an increase in the number of troops to be sent to Iraq, up to 50,000 in what is called the surge strategy. They're supposedly going to be deployed temporarily. How many times did we hear that in Vietnam? And which proves the priceless quote from Colin Powell saying that the American army is not large enough to secure Baghdad, let alone the rest of Iraq. It's a plan that has been condemned by a lot of Democratic lawmakers, but not all. Harry Reid first came out for it before changing his mind and deciding he was going to come out against it. It's also got some other influential opponents, namely all of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all of the generals who have dared speak out on the topic one way or the other. have said this is insane. You know, the war in Iraq needs a political solution, that more U.S. soldiers is just going to create more violence. Of course, George Bush, despite the overwhelming referendum on the war that was the election in November, is the decider in chief. And what he has decided is to go on with his Peter Pan fantasy of a constitutional democracy that has already now been established in Iraq. It's just mind-boggling. It could really do with an active and visible anti-war movement in the streets in this country, but you know, that doesn't always seem to be happening. So,
all right. And there also seems to be some new information out this week on spending for that.
Yes, conflict. Yeah. There's quite a bit, actually. First of all, the Pentagon has announced what it wants for the supplemental budget that will be asked for 2007. That speculation had been that it would be anywhere from $80 to $160 billion. It's going to turn out to be $99.7 billion. So not nearly as much as it could have been, but still a substantial chunk of change. Particularly when you understand that $70 billion has already been spent off the books. Of course, the Bush strategy all along has not been not to put the Iraq war spending or the Afghanistan war spending, for that matter, in the actual budget, but to keep doing supplemental appropriations for it in that way. That way it doesn't make the numbers look quite so bad in the actual federal budget. It's sort of an accounting trick of hand that is fooling nobody, probably. At the same time, the White House has approved a spending plan for the 2008 Pentagon budget that will be $469 billion. You're still talking more money on military than the rest of the world combined. And of course, a lot of that spending is going for Afghanistan and Iraq. And Bush, in his press conference on Wednesday, also called not only for an increase in the troop deployment to Iraq, but an increase in the size of the military in general in the United States, so that we have more troops to fight more wars in more parts of the world, as well as putting more troops in Iran. And Iran also, probably. And, you know, I don't entirely understand where he thinks those soldiers are going to come from. It's not like they're, you know, sitting in freeze-dried form in the closet and you can just add water and they spring forth fully trained. But there you have it. That's the fantasy world of George W. Bush. Other stuff going on around Iraq this week. Four Marines have been charged with murder in the November 2005 slayings of a couple dozen Iraqis, at least 10 of whom are women and children. Four more, those were all enlistees. Officers, four of them have also been charged with cover-up crimes in regard to that to that incident and the investigation thereof in the military. So it really is the first time that the army and the military in general has gone harshly after this sort of the perpetrators of this sort of a crime, even though there have been any number of different reports of atrocities being committed in Iraq over the last 4 years.
And that particular one being in Haditha.
Yes. Yeah. We had a report by the Pentagon that the U.S. soldier suicide rate has doubled between 2004 and 2005. And another report from the Pentagon saying that attacks against, this is part of their normal quarterly report covering between August and November, saying that attacks against U.S. and allied Iraqi forces have increased to an all-time high. As of mid-November, they were at 960 per week, which is a huge number. It's you know, 150 or so per day, and that is probably a very underreported number, because we've had any number of different accounts from people in the military saying that they were encouraged by their superiors not to report attacks against troops unless there were casualties, unless there was substantial damage that had to be reported, et cetera, if it was just a bomb that went off that didn't hurt anybody, or mortar fire that missed, that nobody was going to report it. So probably many, many more attacks than that 960 per week actually going on in Iraq. We had a very ominous development in terms of the types of attacks that are being carried out within the sectarian war, when what was probably, at least according to the MO that's been happening for the last couple of years, probably death squads, raided the offices of the Iraqi Red Crescent in Baghdad and kidnapped a number of the staff people there. The Red Crescent, of course, being the Islamic equivalent of the Red Cross, and they're supposed to be sacrosanct in a war zone. They're also really the last remaining major relief agency in Iraq, and that may well shut down operations for them as well. A very, very sobering development in Baghdad. And we also had this very sobering quote from Condoleezza Rice when she was asked about all that money that was being spent on the war in Iraq. Quote, I don't think it's a matter of money. And you can add three dots there. And that this is a country that is worth the investment. Saying, in other words, basically, that it's worth the cost of all the people that are dying over there. That, of course, is an almost identical quote to what Madeleine Albright popped up with during the Iraq sanctions in the 1990s, when in a 60 Minutes interview in 1996, she was asked if the 500,000 or so Iraqi, mostly children, who had died as a result of the economic sanctions, whether that was worth it. And she said, yes, I think it's worth the price. It's comforting to know that the elite foreign policy establishment in Washington, regardless of party, still thinks life is cheap in Iraq.
All right, moving on to Iran.
Yeah, a couple of developments this week. First of all, local municipal and council elections this early this week in Iran, and the party of the hardliners and President Ahmadinejad took a beating, actually. They finished third in elections, and a fairly distant third at that, between behind moderate conservatives who won a majority of the seats, and then also the reformists who want, you know, greater religious freedom, more ties with the West, etc., also beat out Ahmadinejad's party. So this is fairly widely seen within Iraq among political commentators there as a repudiation of his confrontations with the West in general, and his nuclear program and confrontations with the United States over that in particular. So that actually may be a fairly encouraging sign if he, unlike President Bush in the somewhat less democratic system that is the United States, actually takes a lesson from the elections and decides to change course, as it were. At the same time, we have today, this very day, the UN Security Council is going to vote on a package of sanctions against Iran because of their nuclear program. The United States has been pushing that hard, of course, over the last several months, and has finally managed to bring it to a vote of the Security Council, where it is expected to pass. And then the United States also announced this week that it was sending additional warships to the Persian Gulf to send a message to Iran. Those will join the warships that in the nuclear strike group, etc., that are already parked off the west coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf.
All right, moving along, Palestine.
Yeah, continuing our Islamic Christmas time tour here. Quite a bit happening in Palestine this week. Of course, as we reported last week, Hamas and Fatah factions fighting fairly quickly degenerating into a situation of civil war in Palestine as well. There was a tentative ceasefire that was called last Sunday. That crumbled almost immediately. Street battles continued throughout this week. Mahmoud Abbas, the president, who is aligned with the Fatah party, had announced last week that he wanted to call early elections in a fairly naked bid to try and end Hamas's rule of the legislative branch of the Palestinian Authority. He is doing so with United States backing, of course, and the United States, Condoleezza Rice, announcing again this week that they will spend tens of millions of dollars additional in strengthening the Fatah party security forces. This essentially is taking sides in the civil war. You also had Hamas announcing that they will boycott the elections. So if those elections go off and Hamas does not participate, you're going to get a situation where both sides are claiming they are the legitimate rulers of the Palestinian Authority, and that is an almost certain invitation to civil war. Not a very good situation there. And then in Syria this week, we had a couple things going on also. First of all, we had Israel announcing that it wanted no part of the call by Syria for having peace talks between Israel and Syria. And then also, we had the United States announcing, at least according to Time magazine, that George Bush is considering a plan to fund the opposition groups within Syria to the presidency and the dictatorship there. That, of course, would be similar similar to what he has already done in Iran, trying to fund opposition groups there. And you know, the opposition groups did not do badly in the recent elections there, but it was by and large not the opposition groups that were being funded by President Bush, those being more the ethnic minorities along the hinterlands in Iran, and those have not had a whole lot more political power. Basically, in the Islamic world right now, if you're a democracy movement, you don't want funding from the United States and George Bush because it discredits you in the eyes of the constituents that you hope to win over. So if George Bush thinks that funding opposition parties in Syria is going to strengthen those parties, he is, as Husker Du once sang, sadly mistaken. Finally, did we have anything else in the... Oh, yeah, that was it for this, the Islamic world, for our tour for this week.
All right. Well, we still have some time left. We have one event that we'll put in at the end, but... as we do every year, your publication does, a regular overhyped and underreported stories for each year.
Yeah, it's something we've done for 11 years now. At least this is the 11th year that we're doing it. And every year it gets a lot of play and, you know, radio interviews, and it gets reprinted in a lot of places and so forth. The overhyped and underreported stories of the year. Next week will be a slow news week, too. So let's do the overhyped this week, and we'll do the underreported next, and just sort of run through them casually here. There were a number of overhyped stories, of course, the U.S. media being what it is. Some of the most interesting, actually my choice for number one, is the whole narrative that electing Democrats is going to make everything better in 2007. That is something that I think of liberals and people, a lot of liberals and people on the left, as well as mainstream media or corporate media, really played into with the elections this year, that this is going to be a huge pivotal election in terms of what Congress and what our government is going to do. Not really so much, because as we've seen already, Democrats are very much going to pick and choose which things they want to confront President Bush on, and it's largely going to be the stuff that's less controversial. So things like the war in Iraq or a possible Supreme Court nomination is still going to take a lot of public pressure to get Democrats in Congress, the ones that are controlling Congress now, to do the right thing. So that was very much an overhyped story. Similarly, we had, as a result of the election, this narrative coming out that it was a triumph for conservative Democrats, the so-called blue dog Democrats, because those were many of the candidates that were run by the conservative people, Rahm Emanuel and folks like that. But at the same time, that was only one arm of the Democratic win, and of course, a lot of it had nothing to do with the Democrats at all. It had everything to do with the repudiation of the neoconservatives and the Republicans. But to the extent that it was a Democratic victory, you could credit that, but you could also credit a highly energized activist base, which is largely progressive. You could also credit Howard Dean's 50-state strategy and so forth. So there were quite a few different interpretations there, and media only seized on the one of them. A number of other things that you could point to as overhyped stories this year. American Idol certainly being one, and JonBenet Ramsey being another. You know, she's hot, she's sexy, she was six, she's dead. It's really, really kind of gross when media seizes on stories like that, but it does seem to happen all the time. Back to the election, we had John Kerry's bad joke. Okay, he can't tell jokes very well, but he wasn't running for anything. It was a fairly naked Karl Rove ploy, and that wasn't surprising. What was surprising, that media picked up on it and treated it as much, much more of an indictment than it was. And if you're going to take malapropisms and condemn a party over them, then Kerry should have been president, because George Bush should have never gotten away with 2004. He makes so many of those types of errors in his speaking. Speaking of politicians and overhype, Barack Obama, he's not running for anything at the moment, although you wouldn't be able to tell it by the number of stories that are coming out on him and the fact that he's touring the country and hyping his book. But, you know, he is black and a lot of whites like him, and therefore he's newsworthy. Go figure. It tells us a lot more about the media's priorities than it does about the country. And speaking of presidential candidates, or at least potential ones, Russ Feingold's censure motion in early 2006 got a lot of attention for the fact that it only got something like, what, four additional co-sponsors in the Senate and had actually no impact whatsoever, except that it may have convinced Russ Feingold not to run for president, because there's no way his party would ever support him. Are you listening, Dennis Kucinich? Another thing under overhyped that some people will object to my putting here, but I think should be, is electronic voting machines. There are some parts of the country where they've been a real problem, but a lot of parts of the country, including King County, where they by and large haven't been, or at least nobody been able to prove it. Meanwhile, you've got at least two other stories related that are much more important. One is the fact that there have been voter suppression, purging of voter rolls, any number of other things that have interfered with vote counts that haven't gotten as much attention. And second is the general loss of public confidence in the voting process itself, which has something to do with electronic voting machines. It also has to do with the corruption of the entire political process. And that actually is a huge story. We have February 22nd was an interesting day in our news because the Dubai port scandal was the top story of the day. Meanwhile, you had this as yet unidentified in terms of its origins bombing of the Ankara Mosque in Samarra, Iraq, which basically helped trigger full-scale civil war in Iraq. It's like, which was the more important story? But the Dubai one was the one getting all the headlines that day. And on a similar note, the killing of al-Zarqawi, the terrorist in June, that was supposed to be a turning point in ending all the violence in Iraq. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, did it? And speaking of terrorists, there were plenty of terrorist plots, quote-unquote, that were, quote-unquote, uncovered this year that turned out not to be much plots at all. The British guys who were going to, you know, blow up airliners crossing the Atlantic with toothpaste or something that they assembled in airplane lavatories. We had all the Canadians who were busted for planning to blow up every significant building in Canada over a long weekend. We had those clowns in Miami who were busted for talking loosely. I mean, you know, every time something like this happened, it gets hyped as this, you know, major coup in the war against terrorism, and the charges are quietly dropped or they're just forgotten about or something because there really wasn't much there to begin with. Finally, we need to talk about the Iraq Study Group, which, you know, for all of the hype, basically told us what we already knew, i.e. the war is a disaster, and then gave us a bunch of prescriptions that were never going to be enacted by either party, let alone the president. So a lot of hype there about not very much. It would have helped, of course, if President Bush had two brain cells, and if he did have, if there were a scientific study that proved he had brain cells, that probably would be overhyped too. Fortunately, there hasn't been any such a story in 2006.
So the science would just be denied.
Yes.
All right. What do you have for events?
Well, there's one coming up tonight, which is that Sergeant Ricky Clausing, who is a GI war resistor from the Seattle area, I think it was Auburn or Sumner or somewhere down in that area. He has been cooped up in Fort Bragg for the last few months as a result of his resistance. He is coming home tonight, and there will be a welcoming party for him out at SeaTac Airport. It is going to gather at Concourse B, Baggage Claim 11 at, what time is it now? 10:15 p.m. tonight. So you have nothing better to do or nothing more exciting to do on a Saturday night than going out to SeaTac Airport on a holiday weekend, bring some signs and welcome Ricky Clausing back to home and back to Seattle after his resistance to the Iraqi war.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State, and quickly tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State's in a fun drive right now. If you're thinking of being generous for the holidays, leave something in our stockings by all means. It comes out every couple of weeks. It's a volunteer publication that is free around town where you find free publications, bookstores, libraries, King County Library System, etc. We are also on the web, and you can also donate on the web through PayPal. All of our back issues are there too. The URL is www.eatthestate.org. We are always interested in donations, volunteers, feedback, comments, anything like that. Our voicemail to give us a call is area code 206-719-6947.